Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Makeshift addiction treatment centers are widespread in Mexico, called anexos. Their methods have been described as harsh, violent, even abusive. But the centers have also been described as a refuge by some of the parents who would rather place a son or daughter there than have them become a victim of a deadly drug war. Stanford anthropologist Angela Garcia spent years studying these illegal and informal addiction treatment centers in Mexico City and also discovered them in California, from Riverside to the Bay Area. We'll find out what the existence of anexos and the methods they use say about the brutal realities of Mexico's drug war. Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stanford anthropologist Angela Garcia writes in her new book called The Way That Leads Among the Lost. I didn't go to Mexico to study the drug war. As an anthropologist, I had already spent years among families struggling with addiction problems in the United States, families like my own. Mexico was my destination for vacations and roots trips, for sharpening Spanish language skills, and for romantic rendezvous. And yet, when Garcia learned of the existence of anexos, informal illegal addiction treatment centers, she felt compelled to know more about the controversial centers that use extreme, even violent methods on some of their clients, and yet demand for them was growing dramatically. Angela Garcia, welcome to Forum.
Thank you.
So if anexos were not the original focus of your research in Mexico City, how did you come to learn about them?
I came to learn about them the way some anthropologists discover their subjects of study, and that is through a taxi driver who picked me up from the research site where I was originally working. And we were talking about healthcare in the country and addiction in particular. I told him I had written about addiction in New Mexico, which is where I'm from. And he started talking about his own family struggles with addiction, and then drove me to the place where he said his daughter was housed, and he described it to me as an anexo. I said I had never heard of such a place, and then he went on to describe what the place was and said to me, you know, anexos are everywhere in the city. And really, I found later on, after a decade worth of research, that he was in fact right. They really are peppered throughout the city, particularly in working class and poor neighborhoods.
And not exactly hidden in the way that one might think, in the way that he showed it to you, right?
Right. What he showed me was a building that didn't advertise itself as a clinic. It was a house behind a gate. It was secluded, but everyone knew what it was. Everyone who was sort of from the neighborhood knew what it was. If I had just passed by it, I would have no idea what it was. And that's the thing about anexos. They tend to be sort of embedded within neighborhoods, often within tenement apartment buildings, hidden from view purposefully because they are illegal. But nevertheless, the people who dwell within these areas all know of their existence.
Now, you learn that their methods can be quite extreme, from how they bring someone to the anexo to some of the treatment methodologies that they use. Can you tell us about Hortensia, who called an anexo for her son, Daniel, who was using drugs and was a low-level drug user, and how they took her son to the anexo?
She called upon a number that was given to her by a neighbor who also had a son who was in similar circumstances, and she called the number and arranged to have her son picked up. She didn't know what that would mean until two men arrived at her door and basically pushed their way in, grabbed Danielle, beat him, tied his hands behind his back, and slipped a hood over his head and dragged him out. And when Hortensia saw this, she immediately regretted her decision and said that she wanted, to stop the abduction. But she also knew that this was the only possibility she had for helping her son, and that if he had not been taken to an annexo, as she had planned, he would still be on the streets in a neighborhood which was intensely insecure, where there was neighborhood and criminal violence that he had become involved in, and she wanted to remove him from that danger. But again, her only resource was these spaces that she knew were also going to place him in harm's way. But she had to make that ethical wager to decide what was best for her son.
There are thousands of annexos in Mexico City. It's hard to know for sure, but you estimate that there are thousands. And so they have a range of methods that they use to bring people into the annexo, but typically it's, not something that they choose to do on their own. And you spoke with mothers who described similar experiences, right, of how their kids were taken to this annexo.
Yes, I did speak with a number of mothers who arranged to have their kids and sometimes their spouses abducted. They were generally more confident about abducting their spouses, didn't feel quite as bad about it. But with their children, they had a degree of ambivalence. But again, always feeling like they were making the right decision. But I do want to say that there were some anexados, those are the name for the people who live within anexos, who voluntarily committed themselves. Mm-hmm. So there are, there's an element of people who choose to go into these spaces knowing that they are really the only resource they have for themselves to address addiction.
How did some of the people who run them justify this way of bringing them in?
The people that run them, mostly known as padrinos or godfathers, and sometimes madrinas, godmothers, these are tough people. A lot of them have been in the drug trade. They've worked, they've struggled with addiction themselves. They feel like this method works. That's what they often said to me. It works because people cannot resist. This is the way that we bring them in. It is effective. But it does something else. It places the individual... it makes them feel extremely vulnerable. And that vulnerability is something that padrinos and those who work in annexos want to induce, because they want people to feel like, oh my God, I'm being kidnapped, I'm going to be disappeared or killed, only to then realize that in fact, they're being taken to this place where they're going to be given another chance to live. So it's that fear that is actually something that is cultivated through the abduction. And then later, there's again the recognition of not being killed, not being disappeared, but actually being released into a community of people that are similarly situated.
Wow. And these padrinos and madrinas, they're not like formally trained as addiction treatment specialists or psychologists or therapists.
They're not, but they are trained in the sense that they too were anexados. So they were those who were abducted at one point, and then they moved up the ranks to become counselors, and then eventually often end up, starting their own annexo. So in that sense, they do receive training, but it's not the kind of professional training that we're used to thinking about.
And once there, people are often under a very regimented schedule and so on. But you also describe a process of confession called Desahue, am I saying that?
Desahue.
Desahue. Yeah, can you describe what that is?
The word means to drain in Spanish, and it refers to a ritual draining where anexados are forced to stand above before their peers, and they are essentially harassed to tell a story. They're pushed to tell a story, to go deeper and deeper and deeper, really into the story of their own lives, the wretchedness of their experiences, the depth of their sorrow. It's a very intense form of testimony, and it lasts for hours and hours and hours. And at the end of it, there is what some anexados have described to me as a form of catharsis or release, where they feel that they've, let go of a lot of built-up pains that have been built up over the course of a lifetime. And so I started recording these confessions and began to look at them, not only to understand what the process of treatment in an exos was like, but to also understand what the lives of the people who were giving confessions were like, because they were often reflecting on their experiences within families, within neighborhoods, and were reflecting some harsh realities about Mexico itself.
This confessional aspect, are some of the methods at an exos informed by religion?
Yes, very much so. There's a strong Catholic sensibility to an exos. There are in all the annexos I saw, there's, you know, religious paraphernalia, crosses, rosaries. There are certain forms of bodily comportment that anexados are trained in, and one of which is kneeling on their knees and holding their hands outstretched in the sign of the cross. And they'll have to hold that position sometimes for hours as a form of discipline. But there's a very strong connection to a kind of popular Catholicism that's practiced in the neighborhoods where these annexos are located. And of course, there are all the saints. There are many, many saints that statues that also are present in these spaces as well.
You talk about being taken aback by some of the methods that you witnessed, especially people being brought in sometimes in ways that, you know, would make you take your breath in, or also even witnessing some of these desaues. What made you sort of shift your perspective on what they were from that initial reaction?
I think the key for me was committing myself to spend a lot of time in spaces that initially made me very uncomfortable. And I realized that there was something, early on, I realized that there was something going on here that was more than just addiction treatment. I realized that these spaces were saying something about the world in which they were situated. And so I wanted to understand that. And the only way I could was by dedicating myself to the kind of research that I did, which lasted really a decade, of going back and seeing what was happening, seeing the proliferation of these spaces, seeing the changing populations in which they held. People were getting younger and younger and younger. The kinds of the reasons they were there were also changing. It was less about drug addiction and more about their susceptibility and vulnerability to violence, which is why mothers ended up having them abducted and taken to these places. So it really required, my understanding really required what we would call, you know, in-depth ethnographic research, a long-term commitment to understand a subject and to not have preconceived ideas of what these spaces were, but to really let them tell me what they were through observation.
You say something so striking in your book when you describe these annexos as a gray zone. You say they occupy a crucial position along a continuum of violence, especially since many of their practices, kidnappings, physical discipline, verbal abuse, forced confessions, were shaped by the war that existed beyond their walls. Listeners, I want to invite you to join the conversation. How do you feel about what you're hearing about the way annexos operate? What questions do you have for Angela Garcia about annexos? 866-733-6786, the number to call, the email address forum@kqed.org. Our social channels are @KQED Forum. More with Stanford Professor of Anthropology, Angela Garcia, after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stanford anthropologist Angela Garcia writes in her new book, The Way That Leads Among the Lost, an annex, the name for a clandestine low-cost drug recovery center. Annexos are controversial for their illegality and use of violence. But for many Mexican mothers, they're the only way to ensure a child's safety from the danger that surrounds the narco war. Why are they so widespread? Why were they proliferating, especially while you were doing your research? What need are they filling in Mexico?
They're filling certainly the need for addiction treatment, but also for help with issues around mental illness. A number of the people that I met in Annexos did not identify as having a drug problem, but they were known to suffer from PTSD, anxiety, depression, really sort of diseases that have increased dramatically over the past 2 decades with the increasing violence that has really affected all of the country. At the same time, there have been decreases in funding of mental health. The mental health infrastructure in Mexico is really in disarray. There aren't enough resources to care for people with addiction or problems with mental health. And so these places really fill that void, and they've proliferated, I write and believe, because of the proliferation and intensification of violence in certain neighborhoods. They become spaces of refuge, spaces of refuge that have their own problems, certainly, that are troubling, and I always try to keep that in view in the book. But nevertheless, given how intense the violence has gotten, criminal, neighborhood violence, family violence. Annexos are meant to kind of provide, a sort of small little world that is in some ways protected from those concerns. And yet at the same time, there's no way of it, securing sort of the border of violence in any kind of, firm way, because they do operate in a very violent manner. So on the one hand, their response is to violence, but they're also utilizing violence in their response to it.
Right.
So it's a little bit difficult to kind of tease out what's going on there at sometimes. But the quote that you read about it being a continuum of violence, one of the things that I really tried to understand was why and how their practices of care were suffused with some of the symbolism of narco violence. Why, for example, abduction, kidnapping, which we often think about when we think about the narco war. We see the images, we know what it looks like. These images have proliferated in our media entertainment industry. So they're building on these sort of symbolic images, but they're doing it for another reason. And so I became very interested in the kind of the way that violence and care are interwoven with each other. And that's a primary focus of the book.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because you're not necessarily passing judgment or even saying that it works or doesn't work. I think the question that I wonder about is, what are some of the worst impacts that you've seen on their clients using this methodology? We've talked a little bit about what some of the benefits it can provide in terms of safety, but what have you witnessed as some of the worst impacts of it?
I have worried especially about women, and my concern, because I leave at night. I would go observe during the day, and then I would go home at night. I don't know what would happen at night, and I was always very concerned about the safety of women, the safety of certain young men. I didn't know what night was like. Mm-hmm. And so I can't speak to that part of the day in the life of an anexado. I worried a lot about how being cooped up in these spaces, which tend to be one room filled with sometimes dozens of people, would exacerbate things like depression, schizophrenia, forms of mental illness. And that was something that I worried a great deal about. Is this place driving this person crazy, or were they crazy when they came in? That was something that I kind of always was trying to discern. And I think the other worry was really the worry of mothers who would, have to wrestle with their decision. Did I do the right thing? Is my child okay? I know they're being abused. I know that they're being yelled at. I know that these are harsh living conditions. Am I doing the right thing? And I listen to women wrestle with that decision in ways that, you know, there's profound ethical deliberation that ordinary mothers would have to go through in making these decisions. And so I saw these ethical deliberations as really an opportunity to think about sort of, you know, not only questions about motherhood and family relations and all of that, but like, what does it mean to be so pushed against a wall, to be so stripped of opportunity and resources that this is the only thing that you have available to them? How do you live with that decision? And that was something that I was very attuned to during the research process.
Well, listener David writes, could you ask Angela Garcia about the legal harm reduction centers for fentanyl users? Two I've heard of are Verter and Prevencasa, both near the U.S.-Mexico border. They are places to provide users a safe, supervised place for using. I mean, is the proliferation of Anexos a direct result of not enough quality legal state sanctioned centers to meet needs?
Absolutely. There are, of course, regulated treatment centers, some of which are simply out of the reach of poor people. They cost. The other centers that are government run have very, very long waiting lists. And they're also places that have been described in many Mexican newspapers as also being sites of violence, of also being overcrowded, of also being poorly run. So it's sometimes, if something is regulated, it doesn't necessarily mean that the quality of care is necessarily better. And there's an interesting story. Some Anexos went through a process of trying to become regulated. And in the process of doing so, they had to do things like limit the number of people that they would allow in. And one padrino I spoke to said, you know, I went through all the paperwork, I got my place regulated, and then I decided I was not helping my community because I can only have 5 men, 5 women. We had to do, you know, whereas before he had 25 people and he was responding to the needs of his community, of his neighborhood. And he realized that to become regulated actually meant an inability to respond to the incredible need that he was faced with. So he ended up, you know, leaving that clinic and starting an Anexo in another part of town.
We're talking with Angela Garcia, professor of anthropology at Stanford, author of the new book, The Way That Leads Among the Lost, Life, Death, and Hope in Mexico City's Anexos. Angela will also be having a launch event for the book taking place tonight at City Lights in San Francisco at 7 p.m. if you are in the area. Listeners, what questions do you have about Anexos, about what you're feeling, your feelings that are coming up for you about the way they operate? Are you from Mexico? Do you have an experience with addiction treatment there? Have you use an Anexo here in the United States? Do any of Angela's stories about Anexos resonate with you in some way? Do you feel like you experienced something similar? And what do you think the existence of them says about the impact of the drug war socially, psychologically, economically? 866-733-6786, the number. Our social channels are at KQED Forum on X or Instagram. Our digital community is on Discord. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. Let me go next to caller Starchild in San Francisco. Starchild, you're on.
Good morning. It's a fascinating topic. You know, it reminds me, though, not just of other drug rehab places, but of conversion therapy, you know, where they basically abduct, you know, queer people and take them in to get, quote unquote, cured of their homosexuality. So I think as much as, you know, one tries to spin this or put a positive face on it, I'm not saying that's what Angela's doing, but, you know, I think it's fundamentally unjustifiable. It's coercive. It's not compatible with upholding the respect and dignity for individuals that we want in a free society, and it excuses potentially all kinds of other aggression against people. Now, if somebody as an individual made an advance contract saying, if I'm ever addicted to drugs, you know, I consent to be abducted in this manner and subject to this kind of treatment, that would be different. But for another person to do it, you know, on behalf of somebody where, you know, they may think it's in the person's best interest, but they may be wrong. They're not that person. They have no right to make that choice. And it doesn't surprise me that the voluntary sector is more effective in some ways, like the guy that made an Exos and then decided, he wanted to get regulated. And then after going through the process, I realized it was less effective because they had all kinds of unnecessary rules about occupancy and so forth. But that notwithstanding, it's still not addressing the fundamental problems in society that are causing the addiction.
Yeah.
And it's still aggression against the individual, and I think completely unjustified.
Well, Sarchal, thanks for sharing your feelings about it. As you were saying, Angela, the rationalization you would often hear is that it was for their safety. But you also wondered if they were really safe. Now, you cite a couple of things, like in a report you once noted that government officials described them or alleged that drug cartels used on Exos to hide criminals. What did you learn about the veracity of that?
I never learned any. That's something that I did not encounter myself. I did not ask people about their histories of drug use or drug dealing. I just wanted to sort of stay away from that and observe the activities in the day and also talk to the family members outside of the Annexos. I do want to say that I agree with the caller. This is a kind of conversion therapy in some ways, except that there is a sense and a knowledge that really, recovery from addiction is not really the key issue. The key issue for families that put their kids in these spaces is keeping them safe from the violence that is intensifying in their communities. And also, sometimes these spaces make women safe because they will put abusive husbands in them. They might put children that are abusing them, stealing from them, etc. So they're also used in that way. They're in many ways a kind of community resource. They take, they do a lot of different kinds of work. One of the key kinds of work, though, that they do is try to address problems of addiction, which are, worsening in the country.
Yeah. At one point, a colleague actually recommended to you that you move every week while you were researching Annexos. Why?
Well, things were getting, as they say, at the time when I was kind of finishing up my research, very hot. There were the neighborhoods I work in and had been working in were highly insecure. I would walk out of buildings that were known to be Annexos. People were probably wondering who the hell I was when I would go in and then leave. Friends of mine were concerned about my safety and suggested that, it's important to kind of not always go home to the same place every night, that it would be good to sort of be on the move. And that I realized at that point, okay, maybe it's time to wrap up my work because things are just getting a little too tense, a little too uncomfortable. And but that recommendation really suggested to me just how vulnerable people really are. I was able to move every week if necessary, but the people that live in houses and tenements and communities for all of their life and are seeing them become sort of suffused with violence, they're not able to move. They might have at one point thought about migrating to the United States, but that's less and less, an option for people right now. And or they may have moved to the provinces, but the provinces are where, the drug war is sort of most heavily felt. And so, a lot of the people that I met in Annexos actually were from the provinces of like Guerrero, Michoacan, who fled their hometowns, went to the capital thinking it would be safer, only to realize the problems existed there too. And so their teens and others would end up in these spaces in Annexos.
Well, listener Diane writes, it sounds like Annexos are what we call therapeutic communities that were very popular a few decades ago. Some became notorious like Synanon, but there is never a rigorous evaluation of the long-term outcome. Is sobriety, just like there isn't with the current menu of drug treatment programs, including AA and most of the residential drug treatment programs funded by our SFDPH. The methodology of therapeutic communities includes breaking down people to their most vulnerable self. In my experience as an HIV nurse for 40 years, our people are already broken down and need to be built up, loved and supported on their journey to a healthier self, just like all of us when we seek to be our healthiest self.
Yes, these are therapeutic communities. And, in terms of being broken down, people arrive broken down. Then they are broken down further. And then the hope is that they will be put back together. And what I saw in terms of being put back together is, you know, relationships, friendships, romantic relationships actually flourish in these spaces. People are amongst their peers and they're able to share stories that they recognize. They're not suffering alone. And that, to me, is one of the, I guess, the benefits of these spaces, is that people have witnesses to their pain. They get to the point, many an exilo said to me, you know, before I got here, I didn't feel, but I got here and now I can actually feel. And they feel pain. They reflect on their childhoods. They reflect on their own actions. And in doing so, they begin to do something like put themselves back together. Yeah. But what's going to happen when they leave is unclear. You know, people cycle in and out of these spaces, just like addicts in this country cycle in and out of treatment. And it can be very, very hard to do follow-up to see, you know, what the ultimate outcome is.
And maybe that's the best of the possible impacts of this. But you also make a point to say in your book that you really did avoid the ones that seemed really questionable, very violent, where maybe the padrinos who ran them didn't have the interests of their clients in mind at all. You did avoid those, right?
I did. And I avoided them on the advice of many of the padrinos I talked to, who would say, you know what, you don't want to go there. It's really tough. It's really hot. You don't want to go there. And then also anexados who I would talk to about their previous experiences in anexos. And I should say, one of them told me that his first experience in an anexo, which sounded like hell, was actually in El Paso, Texas. And so I began to then learn of all of the anexos that are on this side of the border, some of which run very similarly to those that I studied in Mexico City, but also others that run a little differently to respond to the needs of people in this country.
And that, I really want to get into the ones that you discovered here, because I have wondered if the methods that you were witnessing in the anexos in Mexico City were in response to the realities of the drug war, the incredible violence and tragedy that accompanies it, and the conditions politically, economically, and so on. What were the anexos like in the United States? Let me remind listeners, we're talking with Angela Garcia, and you are invited to join the conversation with your questions about anexos, how you feel about the ways that they operate, what you think the existence of them and their proliferation says about the impact of the drug war socially, psychologically, economically. Do you feel like you experienced something similar or heard about something similar? Maybe you're from Mexico and have an experience directly with addiction treatment there. Again, the number is 866-733-6786. The email address is forum@kqed.org. Our social channels are @KQEDForum on Twitter or X, Instagram, or on our digital community on Discord. You are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Anexos are controversial for their illegality and use of violence, writes Angela Garcia in her new book, The Way That Leads Among the Lost. The Stanford anthropologist spent years visiting, studying Anexos. But she writes, for many Mexican mothers, they are the only way to ensure a child's safety from the danger that surrounds the narco war. You, our listeners, are weighing in, and let me go next to Ana Maria in Sacramento. Ana Maria, you're on.
Yes, hello. I very, very much agree for any kind of system that believes that you need to break somebody down and use violence for their highest good, for their own good. I just do not support that kind of thing whatsoever. I'm a mother of four. I did have problems with one of my children when they were teenagers, got into drugs. And yet, I never would have done that to them. That breaks trust. That is not real love. I don't need to punish or put you in a worse situation to show you how much I love you. That is, to me, very, very disturbing. And I just don't feel any justification for using violence to fight violence. To punish corporal. That's just the way, you know, the old way of raising a family, that you beat them, you belt them, you get them to use their own stick to beat them with so they could behave themselves. Well, and I do understand that originally that was a way of thinking, well, if I don't beat them, then they're going to grow up and get into big trouble. But, you know, that's no way of doing it.
Well, Ana Maria, trust. Yeah, I really appreciate hearing from you, and thank you for sharing your perspective. Let me go next to Christine in El Cerrito. Christine, you're on.
Hi, thank you. And that's actually my comment piggybacks on what Ana Maria just said. You know, I'm Mexican-American. I've lived in Mexico City. Well, I was there last time I lived there. I was dating a recovering addict. He referred to Padrino as a sponsor, not, I don't think that he was ever in an anexo. But, and I've also worked in rehab here as an interpreter. And I've always been like appalled or intrigued or mystified by this punitive approach to discipline on a more, like a wider societal level, you know. So drug war aside, on all levels of society, I've heard parents talk about these extreme possible consequences, just like Ana Maria did. And like, for example, when I came back, when I moved back here, on two occasions, some paisanos, you know, here would like take my anything that I left unattended and hide it to teach me a lesson. You know, and I'm like, you didn't need to teach me a lesson. You could have just like not taken my stuff, you know. And and so, you know, a lot of parents, they hit their kids because if they don't learn, they'll say they'll end up in jail, you know. And that's instead of talking to them about, you know, antisocial behavior. And so all that said, I'm wondering if the author observed this kind of outlook on a wider scale. And how does this play into the Anexos approach to rehab, and what might be a way through or out of this so that this cycle doesn't self-perpetuate. And I'll listen on air.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you, Christine. Any thoughts for Christine on that?
Yeah, I, well, first I want to say that, you know, anexo is a broad term. And you're absolutely right. Padrino does mean sponsor. And padrinos of anexos are, they're kind of emerging from AA. So this model actually stems from a culturally adapted form of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is very popular in Mexico. And I want to clarify that many anexos, you know, absolutely, you know, are engaged in violence. I describe another anexo in one of my chapters that is an anexo run by and for women, which is located in Ecatepec, which is a municipality outside of Mexico City, which has the highest rate of femicide in Mexico. And a woman who had lost her daughter, who was kidnapped and then later found murdered, started an anexo on the top of her house for the needs of women like her daughter and herself. She called her place an anexo, and I asked her, why do you call it anexo if it felt more to me like a domestic violence shelter or some kind of women's shelter? And she said, because anexos are the place where people go for help. And so, you know, I know it might sound strange and difficult, and, you know, my mode of parenting is certainly quite different than the mode of, you know, many of the parents that I had the fortune to meet. But I think it's, you know, what is frustrating for me is the blanket generalization of anexos as all being criminal, as all being hellish, of being clandestine and bad, that you know, ignores the services that they actually do provide. And I think by closing them all down, we're actually putting people at greater risk.
Is that a concern? Is Mexico planning to regulate or otherwise, you know, crack down on them? Or maybe even the opposite, bring them out of the shadows because they realize they do fill an important need?
Yes. There, I should emphasize, there's absolutely no trust in the system among the communities with whom I work. There was no trust in terms of calling the police. They don't, you know, they have very minimal access to professional healthcare services. They don't trust those. They don't have access to them. So there are closures of anexos, but so many padrinos that I talked to said, you know what, if I can bribe the guy from the sanitation department, give him a few $100s, he'll let me remain open. So there's this constant kind of economy of bribery that allows these places to continue to remain open when they are being threatened to be shut down. You know, there's another, I'm trying to bring it sort of local because there are anexos in our
in
own
Oakland,
backyard
yeah.
in Oakland. And one of the anexos I studied in Oakland was from run by a woman, a madrina, a godmother sponsor, who started the anexo also to serve women like herself, undocumented women with very, very violent migrant journeys. Who are, you know, living on the margins in the Bay Area, having a difficult time affording to make ends meet. And so she created this space where women, yes, could seek treatment for their addiction problems, but also where they could heal together, sometimes utilizing the very methods that I saw in Mexico City that may have appeared to be that were troubling to me, but nevertheless, in this context, they seemed to work. And just really quickly, last night I received an email. This is the kind of email that academics hope to receive, which was from a man who for 20 years was in and out of anexos in the United States and in Mexico. And he said to me, he heard me on another show, he said, "You are the first person to describe the complexity of these places. All of my life, when I have told people about my experience, they have told me I have either been in prison or hell. They never believed that I was in a space of healing. You understand these are also spaces of healing. Doesn't mean they're not prison, doesn't mean that they're not hell, but they also are doing another kind of work. And I really feel that we need to take that seriously, not only in order to try to think about strengthening, you know, mental health care and addiction care, but also to think about what are these spaces saying about the current political and social situation in Mexico today."
And we have touched on that a little bit, but do you want to answer that directly? What are these spaces saying to you about the situation in Mexico today?
I think they say that Mexico, for so many of its citizens, is unsafe. And in order to be safe, people have been forced to create these communities that nevertheless sort of emerge from a space of insecurity. And so therefore, it's not surprising that they would not also engage in practices that come from the local environment that they know. But when people are inside these spaces, parents who put their children in them do feel that they're making the best choice for their families. And they recognize that they are having to make that choice because the state has given up on them.
Let me go to caller Armando in Redwood City. Armando, you're on.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Just wanted to bring my opinion and just my experience being in an annexo in Mexico City. Mm. I live in the United States since 1996, and I have this addiction in New York City in 2013-2014. And I was, unfortunately, in different shelters in New York City trying to recuperate and, you know, try to get away from that addiction. And so I tried to look for help in different hospitals over there in New York City. Unfortunately, it was very difficult to continue with that addiction. So I have to come back to Mexico City and stay with my family. And that helped me a lot to be in with my family. And so, unfortunately, I was looking for that again. And so I have to put myself in an annexo. I never heard that before. So I did it myself and my own. My family didn't even, you know, knew about it. But I took the decision to do it because I wanted to stop. So I didn't know. I hear stories about they, you know, they're being violent and then they were very tough places to be in. But it was it worked for many people. So I did. I went over there. I think the time was 6 months. This was in the period of elections in 2018 in Mexico City, well, in Mexico for presidency. And so so I just literally just stayed there for 2 months because it was very tough. Even though it was helping a lot. It was just too much. It was too much going on in there. Mm. It was the rations of the food. They were pretty small. The food, it was just like, I believe it was two times a day, you know, in the morning and then the afternoon. But it was tough. But it helped me a lot. My family was there, tried to help me. They ask you for money just to kind of help for, it's a fee, I think, every month.
Yeah.
So we don't have any money. So my family just helped bringing food, you know, if it was going to eat. But I live in those annexes. I think it's, they were helping a lot in the community. Now the laws, now with this president, I think with the new, a system. They try to help and be more concentrating on mental health and addiction health. Before 2018, it was very difficult to find this help from the government, and of course the communities and nonprofit organizations. They were trying to help the community, and those annexes were part of that needs in the community.
Yeah. Well, Armando, I can't thank you enough for sharing your first-person experience of that and talking about the complexities that came with your time in an annexo. It is so valuable. I want to remind listeners, this is a fundraising period for many public radio stations, and you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. You talk about the experience of, as you were studying an annexo here, of being told, if you want to keep studying it, you got to go through the program. You have to experience it. Do you want to share a little bit about what that experience was like for you, Angela?
Yeah, the annexo in Oakland that I mentioned, which was run by a woman, you know, she said, you know, in order to continue this research, you have to go through something called an experiencia. And I don't know if the last caller had gone through this ritual, but it's very much aligned with a lot of annexos. They also participate in this, where you go into, if you're in Northern California, you'll go into the forest. If you're in Southern California, you'll go into the desert. And for 3 days, you don't eat a lot. You don't sleep. And you spend time writing, and you're writing about your deepest pains. You're writing about offenses you've committed. You're writing to ask forgiveness, to seek truth. And at the end, and you're supported. You're supported by people. Almost all of the people that were with me in the experience were undocumented immigrants, many of whom had also spent time in a Nexos. And so we gathered together. We were in a campsite in Northern California. We didn't know where because we were not, they covered the windows of the van, so we didn't know we were being driven to, which was very disorienting. And then we arrived and we spent, 3 days, 3 nights together. And we basically, the goal is to reach a kind of cathartic experience. And these experiencias are very common rituals that a Nexos in Mexico also engage in. And so it was during that kind of intense, we didn't eat very much. We couldn't sleep. I mean, it's in some ways it felt like torture at moments, but it also led to, quote, a breakdown. And, when I left and I went home, and I had been dealing with a lot of my own personal difficulties at the time, when I went home, I felt a sense not only of community, but a sense of release and grace. And that was something that could only have emerged if I had met, only through my relations with women who were a part of the underground world of a Nexos in the Bay Area. So this is something that goes on monthly. I'll likely go on another one at some point this summer to do some follow-up work. But I also want to go again this summer because I feel like there's stuff in my own life I want to deal with. And to my surprise, this became a mode of my own, a therapeutic mode for myself, one that I actually wish were made more readily available to others.
Do you think we'll see more a Nexos in Mexico? Because as you were pointing out, the addiction crisis is worsening there, though they provide a lot of other services or treat a lot of people who don't have addiction, as well as you were talking about mental health issues. But do you foresee a lot of them, both in Mexico and even here?
Yes, I think a Nexos dot a perilous landscape that crosses the border. So when things get more difficult in Mexico, as they are, particularly with drug-related narco violence, there are going to be more and more Nexos. And there will also be more here because people are fleeing that violence and they're coming to the United States and they're establishing these sites, not only, again, certainly to deal with problems of addiction, but also to deal with concerns about housing, fears about deportation, et cetera. So we are very much connected to Mexico. And as the drug war continues and intensifies, and Nexos will proliferate on both sides of the border.
And hopefully the ones that you encountered that you felt like were having a positive impact as opposed to the ones that you avoided. Gary writes, I learn through my work in this field that the opposite of addiction is connection. The very first things to go are the relationships, as the person who is addicted to the numbing of their negative experiences must keep using more to achieve the same effect. But sometimes people get addicted for the most innocent reasons. They just start using because it's what other people do. Nonetheless, I find that people can heal their addiction with programs where relationships, connection, and belonging occur. The problem is once a person leaves the environment, it becomes very difficult to continue the practice of connection and maintaining healthy relationships. Life can easily become re-complicated. And of course, if that environment is, as what you're describing, a region in Mexico that is, just suffering under narco violence, it's a very different thing. Do you want to just say one last word about the relief it gave to the mothers, the parents, the spouses who would put somebody in an exo? And we just have 20 seconds.
Okay. Well, I'll say this. One mother I spoke to, she said, after I put my child in the exo, I finally began to sleep and dream. And I was very struck by that because her days had been and nights had been full of worry. And so for the first time, she was able to sleep and dream.
Well, thank you for shedding light on the broader issues that affect Mexico through the lens of a Nexos. Angela Garcia's book is The Way That Leads, Among the Lost. Thank you, Mark Nieto, for producing today's segment. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
There are true monsters in the world. People doing horrible things with impunity. Still, every once in a while, there is born a monster hunter. On the next Snap Judgment, The Road to Boito. Snap Judgment, storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.